Hi, this is Carrie.
And this is Sandy.
And this is
Crime Bitches Countdown.
Welcome back to Crimes That Result in New Laws. Here are another five crimes that resulted in positive change for society.
Case number six. We are going to talk about Adam Walsh. Now, is that name familiar to you?
No.
Oh, man, that really hurts me.
I feel like it should be, but it's
it
not.
It should be. It should be, but, you know, that's fine. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about who he is. All right. Adam was 6 years old. He lived in Florida. All right. 6 years old from Florida. July 27th, 1981, he went to the Hollywood Mall with his mother, Reveille, which, by the way, I love her name, Reveille. It's very
yeah,
pretty.
That's a cute name.
She had gone to, they went to Sears, I should say, and I forget what she was doing. I want to say she might have been returning something or she just had to pick up something real quick. And she left Adam in the toy section while she went shopping. Now, this was, again, the 80s, so this was a very common practice.
Yeah.
When she got back, Adam was gone. Now, she had left him in the toy section, but it was like they had the Atari. God, we're showing ages here. This was the 80s. So they had an Atari display, and there was a couple of boys there playing video games, so he was with them. A teenage security guard had asked the other boys to leave. I guess they were being too rowdy, getting a little too loud, I guess, for this kid. Mm-hmm. He must have assumed that Adam was with them, and Adam must not have said anything, and he just walked out with the boys. Well, as soon as he walked out, he was kidnapped. Reveille had him paged from customer service, and they searched the store for 90 minutes before calling the police. Now, 90 minutes is a long time to search a store. And I don't think Sears were much bigger in the 80s than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
I would have called the police sooner, personally.
Yeah, me too.
But I also understand that, you know, you don't want to bother the police if it's your kid's just hiding and being a jerk. You know?
Yeah, but once you page them, like, you'd think they'd show.
You would, but they searched for 90 minutes. A massive search was conducted, but they didn't have any luck with that. August 10th, 1981, sadly, his severed head was found in a drainage canal by two fishermen. His body was never found. His father was John Walsh. Now, does that name sound familiar? America's Most Wanted, John Walsh?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, John Walsh became an activist, and he helped create several organizations and programs that assisted in locating missing children. He was the host of America's Most Wanted.
Mm-hmm.
He founded the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, so this was partially spurred by Adam Walsh.
Oh.
There are multiple programs or laws that were inspired by the case. The first one will be the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, which created a nationalized system for sex offender registration, which we didn't have before that.
Yeah, very cool.
Team Adam, which is a group that deploys on cases of critically missing children to help with the search. So that's very, very cool.
And yeah, nice.
Code Adam. Have you ever heard of Code Adam?
No.
You'll see it. Actually, Walmart is, like, I think the first place I've ever seen it signed. The sign is put up. But it's a retail store protocol to search and lock down a building before a child can be removed out of it. So if you ever are in a store and you hear Code Adam, it's because they're looking for a child.
Good to know.
Yep. So the case was closed in 2008, and this gets a little hairy. All right. In 1983, Otis Toole confessed. But then, do you know who Otis Toole is? So let me start there. Do you know who Henry Lee Lucas is?
No. I don't know who any of these people are. In the 80s, I was very anti-news.
Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole were serial killers who partnered together and killed a lot of people. Now, they both did a lot of confessing. I mean, Henry Lee Lucas confessed to like 200 murders, but no one knows if he was serious or not. Okay?
Right.
Well, Otis Toole was the same way. So he confessed to killing Adam, then he recanted. And he never got officially charged. He died in 1996. Now, in 1981, there was a lot of evidence that had been botched because they didn't have the protocols we have now. They didn't collect things the same way. There wasn't as much, you know, with DNA or anything like that. So, unfortunately, they messed up. But after some more review from multiple officers in 2006, the law enforcement and the Walshes agreed that it was Tool, and they closed the case. So, whether it was or not, it's hard to say, but everybody kind of thinks it was.
Got it.
So, technically, it's a soft case. It's just a shame that he didn't pay for it.
Right, exactly. Well, I am totally impressed with these parents. Like, I, as sad as it is, I feel like I would be one of those parents that just didn't want to think about it anymore. Like, would have to distract myself and not want to think about, you know, my missing or murdered child. And yet there are these parents that can overcome that depression and fight. And fight and make it so that, you know, action is taken and new programs are put in place so that other parents don't have to, you know, feel the same way they do. And I'm super utterly impressed by those people.
So a lot of these parents actually get a lot of accolades for the work that they do. And they're always invited to, like, right, they get awards, they get invited to speak. And a lot of them, even if their case has been solved, still assist with helping missing children. Mm-hmm. And a big part of it, I think, is just that they know how it is. They know what it feels like. So it's kind of awesome that they give back. I mean, and you look at John Walsh, I forget exactly what he did, but he was like some kind of a, I want to say he was like a project development kind of person and was working on buildings. I mean, this was never something he was interested in. And then his whole life became about missing kids, which is pretty awesome. And anybody who's ever watched America's Most Wanted back in the day, you know who John Walsh is. Like, it was just that pinnacle. Like, I can see the intro of America's Most Wanted and him coming, like, out of the dark. This is John Walsh. And I'm like, yeah, you just know who John Walsh is.
But again, I think, you know, in doing all this advocacy, they're reliving their own trauma in a way.
They are.
Absolutely. And it's it's encompassed their entire life, which I understand, and I'm not judging good or bad. I just don't think I don't know that I could do that. And it's not because I obviously wouldn't want other people to be saved or anything like that. It's just because I would be so engrossed with my own sadness.
Yeah.
That I don't think I could move, you know, forward.
Yeah, it's hard to say, you know, I would like to think that, that I would be able to do something like that, but I don't know. It is hard to say. And in a lot of these cases, well, not a lot, all of these cases, like, the laws that they do get changed don't help their cases, which really says a lot, too. It's not like it's going to help them specifically. So they really are doing it for other people, which is great.
Exactly.
Okay, next case. We are going to talk about Megan Kanka. Any ideas?
Megan's Law?
You got it. Megan's Law. All right, so Megan was 7 years old. She was from New Jersey. July 29th, 1994, she had gone down the street to visit a friend. Now, this was, like, towards the evening, but this is July, so, you know, it's not getting dark until, like, 8:30, 9 o'clock. At 8 p.m., she got reported missing. Her parents couldn't find her. Neighbors said they had seen her talking to Jesse Timondakis, which I'm not going to keep saying his last name because I can't.
No,
so we're going to go with Jesse for that. When questioned, Jesse denied having anything to do with the disappearance, but eventually he would confess and lead them to her body. He said he lured her in by offering to show her a puppy, so we both know that we would be dead too.
Yep.
So sad. Don't use puppies against people. So sad.
No, that's just wrong.
Yeah. So once she was inside, he strangled her and assaulted her. I'm not sure of the order of those two items. That was disputed in multiple places. Her body was found next to a portable toilet in Mercer County Park.
Ugh.
Her family was unaware that the three men that lived in the house were all sex offenders. Mm. No one in the neighborhood knew this. Jesse had... I'm not really going to get into the other guys because they don't really matter. And they were looked at, but they had alibis. They had strong alibis. But they were sex offenders. And I don't... Don't hold me to this, but I want to say, like, sex offenders aren't allowed to live together. I could be totally lying about that. I don't know.
Yeah, I never heard that.
Yeah, I thought now that's the law, but I could be so wrong. Jesse himself had two previous convictions. In 1979, he attempted aggravated sexual assault of a 5-year-old girl. And in 1981, he assaulted a 7-year-old girl. When it came to Megan, he got sentenced to death, but later it was commuted to life after New Jersey abolished the death penalty in 2007. Megan's parents lobbied for changes in the law, and Megan's law was passed in New Jersey a few months later. In 1996, Clinton signed a federal version of Megan's law. Now, what does Megan's law actually do? It requires sex offender registration and community notification. So, the federal law only addresses the community notification aspect of it.
Okay.
Because previously, before Megan's law, there was a federal law called Jacob Wetterling Crimes Against Children and Sexually Violent Offender Registration Act. And this had already set...
Damn, that's long.
Yeah. This had already set a standard for registries. It was signed in 1994, but only 5 states were using the registries before Megan's law. So it was kind of new. It was... People were lax on it, you know, so this really wasn't a thing.
They were adopting it, but very slowly.
Now, I figured you're going to be like, who's Jacob Wetterling? So I'm going to tell you about him, too, just very briefly. He was 11 years old. He had rode his bike with his brother and a friend to go rent a movie, probably at Blockbuster. Just
probably.
The three of them were stopped on their way home. A man had been standing in the driveway, stopped them, and he told them he wanted to look at them. He sent the little brother away, sent the friend away, and abducted Jacob. In 2015, Danny Heinrich was arrested, but he was arrested for child porn. And as part of that, when they searched his house, they found some other stuff, and he wound up confessing to the murder and led police to the body in 2016. So that poor family, like, they went years. I want to say it was, like, 20 years or so before they found out what really happened. So, kind of sucks. But Megan's Law is great, and it does let you know about people in the neighborhood. You can go, I don't know if anyone cares or can look, but you can go online and search to see in your neighborhood if people are sex offenders. As a matter of fact, I'm just going to be honest, I know if there's one in my neighborhood, I know exactly where they live. And just kind of a heads up for myself, if my child is out, you know, I'm not going to harass these people, I'm not going to bother them, but I know that they're there.
That's good to know. And so what is, like, the community not, like, the community notification? Does that entail? Like, do you have to send a letter? Like, I know there were some jokes before they had to knock on people's door and just say, hey, I'm a sex offender and I live here, you know.
I don't have a good answer for that because it is up to the individual states and localities, I believe. So there is no standard. They could send letters. They could come around, knock on doors. It could be just that it's posted and available at the police station.
Okay.
You know, community notification can mean a number of things. So that's the best I can tell you. I do think most communities do not send letters. I think most of it's posted on websites or things like that. Like I said, you can go and find sex offender registries for your neighborhood very easily. So all it requires is a search, and if you can't find anything, you call the police, they'll give it to you.
Yeah.
So, the problem for me with sex offender registries, and I think I brought this up before, it's not with the registry, it's with the crimes that are considered to be on the registry. And we talked about that before.
Yes, so, you know, I was going to mention that too.
Yeah, if you peed near a school, nobody cares. But if you flashed a 5-year-old, now I care. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, there is a major difference. For the most part, I think the sex offender registries, you know, there are people who fight against them saying that it's not right because they have to be on it for life. My personal feeling is if you did the crime, do the time. I don't care.
Right.
But right. I agree that there are cases that don't warrant being on the sex offender registry.
Completely agree. Like I said, like you said, if you pee on a school in the middle of the night, you know, no one's going to, whatever, you were drunk. Like, you shouldn't have to be on a registry for that. Simple. I mean, to me, that's not a sexual assault.
Exactly. I agree. And I also think that when people think about the sex offender registry, they think violent crime, and it's not necessarily. If it's two consenting teenagers, you can still wind up on the sex offender registry. And I don't agree with that either. As long as it was consensual, whether, and then you get into the hairy situation of age of consent and all that other stuff, and I'm not going to get into it all, but the sex offender registry, there are people on it who are not what you think they are. And it's unfortunate because some people will see the sex offender registry, they'll look at who in their neighborhood is a sex offender, and they will automatically have an issue. Some people will go after them.
Yep.
And that's not right. You don't know the story. You don't know the history. You can only get so much from the information that you can find.
Exactly. So, a name on a registry.
Some of them will tell you what the offense is.
Doesn't give you right to torture somebody else either.
Yeah. And some of them will tell you what the offense is, or you can look into court records and find it.
Yeah.
But
sometimes it's difficult.
Yeah. Just suffice it to say that not everyone is as evil as we think, although they are out there for sure. And this family with three people living right across the street,
I'm going to be a little offended if three sex offenders can live together, but women can't live together in a house because it's considered a brothel.
Just saying.
I have an issue with this. Perhaps we need to relook things.
You think? I know that's a law in Florida, but I wonder where else that's a law. I know there's other states that have it.
I'm not sure. I just know Florida.
Okay. All right, so the next case we're going to talk about, this one is about Tracy Thurman. I'm going to guess you've probably never heard the name. I will tell you one thing about this case, personally. So my sister, when she was in college, well, when we were both in college, we were in different schools, and she had taken this class. I want to say it was on criminal justice. I don't fully remember. And she said to me, "Do you want to come up and go to this class with me?" You know, and I was really into, like, women's rights and, well, I mean, I still am into all of that. And I was like, yeah, let me go. So I went and I read the book for the class, actually. And it was about this case. And it was the first time I ever heard of it. And it blew my freaking mind and became just even more of a reason for me to be a champion for women's rights. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Tracy Thurman. She met her husband, Charles Buck Thurman, if your nickname is Buck, but whatever, in 1979. They had a son named CJ in 1981. He had hit her for the first time a few months before she got pregnant. Now, she said she hit him back. She was
good,
like, you know, she didn't really think it was very serious. You know, she's like, he slapped me, I slapped him, like, whatever.
Right.
And again, this was in the very early 80s, so domestic violence wasn't really a thing so much. Like, it was definitely kept under... Yeah, it was kept under wraps. She didn't talk about it and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When she was 4 months pregnant, they got married. And she left him in October of 1982. So they were not together very long.
No.
1982. Okay. For the next 8 months after she left him, she called police on him 19 times. I want to explain to you what some of these were. At one point, he had come into her house and taken CJ out, and she called the police, and he was not arrested for that. She got her son back, but that was it. There were numerous threats made to her, like, I'm gonna kill you. He was arrested once for smashing her windshield with his fist while she was at a red light. And I think a police officer watched it happen and only arrested him after someone complained. Or something along those lines. Like, the officer wasn't going to do anything.
Yep.
The police would make excuses why they couldn't do anything, including, and this is my favorite, one time they told her, the officer who has your case is on vacation. So I guess murder has to wait.
Yeah, apparently.
You know? I mean, but that was the kind of thing they would say, like, well, we can't because, no. All right. In May 1983, she received a restraining order. P.S. She also filed for divorce in April of that year. June 10th, 1983, she was 22 years old. She went to a friend's house to do laundry with CJ. Thurman showed up. He was outside. He was ranting and raving and carrying on. She called the police at 1:20 p.m. She waited about 15 minutes before going outside, and she only went outside because he was threatening to come in, and she didn't want him to touch CJ. Or her friend, I mean. So, the police finally arrive 20 minutes after she called. As soon as he saw the police, he attacked her. He stabbed her 13 times in the chest, the neck,
oh my goodness,
the shoulders, and the face. He dropped the knife. Now, mind you, the police officer is here now. He dropped the knife, and he went into the house to grab his son. Now, while that happened, the officer didn't stop him. The officer picked up the knife and put it in his trunk, but did not stop Thurman, did not restrain him, anything like that.
What the hell?
Yeah, well, so he goes into the house, he gets CJ, brings him out, kicks her in the face, drops her son on top of her, says to the kid, "I killed your fucking mother," and, stomped on her face and neck. And broke her neck. Now, after all of this, while she's being, he's still not arrested, mind you. She's being loaded onto the stretcher. The ambulance is there now. She's getting loaded onto a stretcher. And he goes to attack her again, and that's when the police arrest him.
What?
Yes. So this whole time, I mean, they just sat here and watched him, I mean, stomp on her face, kick her. Well, she survived, surprisingly. I'm not going to say it's a quality life, but although I will say that I was just reading an article about her, too, and, like, she's remarried, and she seems to be as happy as you can be.
At that point, how are the police not an accessory to attempted murder?
Well, just wait. So, she spent 7 months in the hospital. I'm surprised it was only 7 months. She's paralyzed on her right side. I thought I had put all of her injuries in here, but I guess I didn't. I mean, she had so many. One of the things that I was reading is that she said it always kind of comes back up in one way or another, because she went to go get a surgery on her throat, and they found pieces of her larynx from his attack that were, like, just
loose. Oh, dear God. Loose.
So, I mean, like, he really fucked her up, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
He was sentenced to 14 years in jail. He only served 8. Of course, he threatened to kill her when he got out, you know, so he's out, and she does live in fear. I mean, obviously, there's a restraining order, and he says he's not going to, but you never fucking know.
Well, there was a restraining order before, and he was able to do that with the police standing right there.
Yeah, restraining orders are good to have, but don't really protect you, unfortunately.
No.
All right, so Tracy sued the city and the police. Because who the fuck wouldn't? And she was actually awarded $2.3 million.
I'm sorry, that's not enough.
No. She wound up settling for $1.9 million when the city agreed they wouldn't pursue an appeal. But this case paved the way for the 1986 Family Violence Prevention and Response Act, or sometimes called the Thurman Law. Mm-hmm. It requires police to make an arrest on a domestic violence call, and the arrested abuser must be arraigned the next day so an order of protection can be put through quickly. So in the past, they didn't have to do anything. If there was a domestic violence call, they could come out and be like, "Oh, you beat your wife? That sucks. All right, bye." They didn't have to do anything. Now when they come out, I think there's a little bit of leeway on an arrest. They might not have to arrest, but they have to remove someone. Someone must leave the premises, for sure. So it really changed the way things were handled, because prior to that, a lot of domestic violence cases were blown off. And at the time, too, another problem was you would have these officers come out and they would talk to women and they would say, "Do you want me to arrest them?" And they would say no, because they're scared. They're terrified.
Exactly.
You know, and they're afraid that if they say yes, they're going to pay for it later. Well, this takes it out of their hands. So now it's no longer up to the victim. Now it's up to the police, which I'm sure still makes things difficult for some victims, but it's good. It's a very good thing. Because you have a lot of victims who will not press charges, which I understand, but ultimately
it doesn't help.
This really did bring to light domestic violence. I mean, it was a pretty extreme case. There's actually, like, a made-for-TV movie that was really good, and tons of books. I mean, you can find so much on this case, and it is just horrible that the police stood there and watched.
It's It's absolutely appalling to hear things like that. I mean, why did you want to be a police officer in the first place, if not to help people and protect society? How can you just stand there and watch and let that happen?
Once upon a time, it was believed that men had the right to beat their wives. And I don't know when that went out the window, but like, I think up and through the 70s at least, that was still not, it wasn't super acceptable, but it wasn't as frowned upon either. It was kind of like a not my
Agreed.
Business thing, you know?
Yeah, but it just, it boggles my mind that it really, it hasn't, I mean, women only gained the right to vote in 1920. So really, I mean, it's been, now it's been 100 years, but like, we were the last to gain the right to vote.
Yep. Yep.
And like, you know, the fact that these things were just dismissed and like, you know, as sad as it is, I mean, slavery went away. And black men were treated better than women.
Slavery is a whole other fucking ball game that blows my mind too.
Exactly. How you can treat another living human being as lesser, I will just never understand. But that goes into the fact that, like, again, women being treated lesser, like it's okay to be, no, I am not here to serve you. Sorry.
Well, and I do think that it really was. I know in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s for sure, it was definitely like, that is a marriage problem and you have to work it out and,
yeah,
you know, whatever. But after this case, because I think part of it too was this didn't happen indoors. This happened in full view of a lot of people. You know, there were witnesses, the neighbors were there, they witnessed it, the police were there. I mean, and the fact that they didn't arrest him boggles my mind too, because why did you wait until she was on a stretcher? What?
Right.
Why did you even let
Why
him pick up
that...
the child? Why did you let him do any of this? You
didn't
should have
know
stopped
what he was
him.
Gonna do to that child, and you
yeah.
just let him walk in after he just brutally assaulted this woman.
Yeah, the whole thing blows my mind. And again, if you ever have a chance to watch the movie or read a book about it, it is just heartbreaking what this woman went through. So I wish her all the best. I mean, she has kind of avoided the limelight. Mostly because
I
she's
can
afraid.
Imagine.
Yeah. She's changed her name, I'm pretty sure, and she doesn't like people to take her picture because she doesn't want him to know what she looks like now. And it's a shame that this far along, she's still afraid.
Well, not only that, but how stable is that child? Like,
that's
really?
A whole other ball game, because he would have been like 2. So old
yeah.
enough to kind of be aware. It's not like he was an infant, you
right.
know. It's a shame. And what I was reading, she said that there are things that upset him, like if he hears police car, if he hears the sirens, he gets a little frantic, especially if she's not home. He worries about where she
yeah.
is. I mean, of course, I would too.
I'm sure.
So
it sucks. I'm obviously glad she survived, and I hope she's doing well, and they're both doing well, but That's just a travesty. An absolute travesty.
Is it wrong of me to say I hope someone beats the fuck out of him?
No.
I hope
I
a
hope
lot
that
of people beat
too.
The fuck out of him, actually. Because he's just a douche. And
yep.
it really pisses me off, too, that he got out in 8 years. I mean, that is not enough time for what you did.
No. Nope.
She's going to have
nope,
problems
not
for
even.
The rest of her life.
Exactly.
Case number 9. Let's talk about it. It is about David Berkowitz. Sound familiar?
Oh, yes.
Do you know his nickname?
Forget.
Son of Sam.
That's it.
Excuse me. So, Son of Sam. This took place in New York City. David Berkowitz, as a child, had violent tendencies and emotional issues. He stole, he destroyed property, he killed animals and set fires. So, of course, those are all indications of a violent future.
Yep.
He had trouble with his social life and relationships. My understanding, what I read, and I don't know how accurate it is that his only sexual encounter occurred while he was in the army stationed in South Korea. He had sex with a prostitute and got an STD. So,
Aww.
Not a good way to start things, and I don't know which one.
Yeah.
I didn't really care. 1975, he sort of snapped. He stabbed two teenage girls from behind. They survived, but they couldn't identify the attacker, obviously, because it was from behind, so they didn't see him. Then he moved next door to a man named Sam Carr, who had a dog that would howl and bark all night, and Berkowitz claimed it drove him to madness. Now, July 1976, he got a .44 caliber gun, and he shot two women sitting in a car talking. He shot them and pretty much ran off, so he didn't know if they were dead or alive, and he only found out later that one of them had died. And I guess that made him happy. So,
was his excuse for killing the women because of the dog?
Eventually, yes. That is something he says later. Yes, but apparently he had a hatred of women because women didn't like him or some shit like that.
Yeah.
So, went on a killing spree for a year, because, you know, after one, you're not done.
Second. The whole Pringles.
So, July 1977, his eighth and final attack. I didn't list them all out. They were mostly couples in cars, was his kind of go-to. On his eighth and final attack was July 1977. In total, he killed 6 people and wounded 7.
Wow.
In April of 1977, so a couple months before this. Alright. In April of 1977, a few months before his last attack, he had begun leaving taunting notes for police, and he had signed them the Son of Sam. Now, prior to that, they had called him the .44 caliber killer. So Son of Sam was his own nickname that he gave himself.
Apparently he didn't like that one.
Yeah, I guess that wasn't fancy enough, you know. After the last murder, witnesses had seen a suspicious man near the scene, and they said he was holding a dark object and removed a parking ticket from his car. So police are like, well, let's look up
parking
the tickets. Let's see what we can find. And they found Berkowitz. So they weren't sure.
Found through a parking ticket.
Yeah, that should have been on our other episode.
Yeah.
But they weren't sure, though, at the time whether he was a suspect or a witness. You know, he could have just been nearby and maybe he saw something that could help. So they went to his home and they saw his car, and inside of it was a rifle, a duffel bag of ammo, maps of the crime scenes, and another letter for police. Now, I'm sure that they didn't see all of this through the windows. I'm sure some of that came out later. But I'm betting they probably saw the rifle and potentially, like, maps. And so that...
Why would you keep that, though, in your back seat?
Are you really asking
windows
these questions?
Windows are clear!
Are you really asking these? Haven't we talked about this?
Oh, dumb criminals.
Yeah. So, he told the police that a man from 6,000 years ago named Sam spoke to him through his neighbor's black lab retriever and told him to kill. Later, he would say he made it up. But yeah, I think he was really going for the insanity defense, which wasn't going to work out in his favor.
Now, you got to try better. You got to try really hard for that. And make up a better story.
So, fucking Son of Sam. He was very all over the media. That's going to be the way I'm going to put that. And he was offered deals to write books and movies and shit. And, you know.
I'm sure.
He pled guilty. He was sentenced to 25 years to life. He is eligible for parole every 2 years. But he is still in prison today. And... I had to read it. I didn't want to read it, but I had to. So he was called Son of Sam, and now he's in jail, and he has a website, and I don't remember exactly what it is. But now they call him the Son of Hope, and he's like a Bible thumper. So he's all about God.
Are you
kidding? Oh, I'm not kidding. I am not kidding. And one of the things that I did read was he said he fully deserves to be in jail, and he does not want to get out. So that's good, at least.
Yeah.
You know, but...
I mean... I'm all for believing people can turn over a new leaf or whatever. I just think it's highly improbable.
If he has, you know, kudos to him, but stay the fuck in jail.
Exactly.
Nobody wants you out. Like, whatever.
That's
but the fact that they call
I
him
feel about it.
The fact that they call him the Son of Hope really kind of irks me, actually.
Yeah, no. Mm-mm.
And cool if you want to minister to other prisoners. That's awesome.
Yeah, but... sweet.
Now, I could have gone into a lot more detail about Berkowitz, but I didn't want...
Of course.
I didn't want to because our focus is not necessarily the crime, but so much as the laws.
Mm-hmm.
So, 1997, New York passed the Son of Sam law. Do you have any idea what that is?
No.
It stops criminals from profiting from the publicity of their crimes through books, movies, TV shows, interviews, etc. So any money that would be received would be given to the criminals' victims. Now,
awesome.
40 states have similar laws. They're all a little bit different because it's a very controversial law on First Amendment grounds. Now, this we're gonna talk about this for a minute because their issue with this is that they're saying it's against your First Amendment right of free speech. My thought is, it's not against your First Amendment. You can write a fucking book. You just can't profit from it. You can
do it. Don't your rights kind of go out the window when you violate the law in the first place?
Well, they should, but no.
I mean, some. You can't vote.
That's true. That is true. But I don't think that... I don't see how it's violating your First Amendment rights when the whole point is that you can't profit from it. It doesn't say you can't do it. You can do it.
You can still speak, you can write, you can do whatever you want. You just can't keep any monies from it, which is different than saying you can't do it.
And that's what I think. But Simon & Schuster, the publisher, sued New York for this law in 1987. They had, I want to say it was like a mafia guy that they wanted to have write a book. And because of this law, it was a big problem and an issue, and they weren't going to be able to do it. So they sued. And the New York law was struck down by Supreme Court as it was too broad and would have allowed any discussion of a crime to be included. The problem with that is what they're saying is, if I said, and David Berkowitz killed 5 people, that would be a violation and I couldn't profit from it. Do you know what I mean? Or, like, if he wrote a book and he was like, and Susie died... Well, you just mentioned the crime. Do you see what I mean? So it wouldn't necessarily have to be a whole book about your crime. It could be a footnote and be a problem.
Yeah.
So it was struck down for that reason. They did update it in 2001 so it wouldn't be as broad. And so far it hasn't been contested. But that is a huge issue, is the First Amendment with this law. I just think I don't see it as a problem. You want to write a book, but you're not going to get any money from it.
Period. Agreed. And no offense, but if he is this son of hope and he's God-fearing now, I mean, why wouldn't he if the money goes to his victims?
Actually, he didn't even care. Family. He didn't even want to be a part of it. He had all these offers for books and things, but he didn't actually want to do them. So it kind of just spurred off the fact that people thought he might, but not so much that he
now,
was going
what
to.
What I'm saying is, like, now...
Oh, he doesn't... I don't even think he cares. Like, he doesn't try to profit off of anything. But you have other people who do, like OJ, right? Mm-hmm. So when OJ wrote his book, and it was called If I Did It, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know what you know about OJ's book. I haven't read it because I don't really care. But it was called If I Did It. And the family, the Goldman family, and I believe maybe Nicole's family as well, sued. And they sued and they said that they wanted the profits... to go, I want to say it went to a charity or something like that. It went to their foundation or whatever. But they also changed the title of the book. So where it had before said, If I Did It, like real big across, now in the I, it's a little tiny if. So now it just looks like when you're from far away, it just looks like it says, I Did It by O.J. Simpson. So they were able to get away with doing that. But yeah, they had to sue to get that money because he was going to try to profit from it.
Nope.
All right. Case number 10. Are you ready?
Ready.
It's about Matthew Shepard. If you don't know who Matthew Shepard is, I might cry.
You might have to cry. That's such a generic name.
All right. When I start telling you the story, you might know it. I'm so mad at you right now.
I'm sorry. Hey, Doug.
Matthew Shepard was 21 years old. He lived in Wyoming. He had lived in...
Oh, that Matthew Shepard.
See, you do know it.
No, I'm just fucking with you.
Are you serious? You're a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
All right. He had lived in Saudi Arabia with his family for a time before he returned to the U.S. to attend the University of Wyoming. Now, one thing that I did not know previously and found out while I was doing this research was on a high school trip to Morocco... he was attacked and raped by locals. I want to say it was like 6 men. And after that, he fell into depression and anxiety, obviously. I mean,
Yeah.
of course. You know, so he had some issues for sure, and I really did not know that it happened to him. I was kind of sad when I read it. October 6, 1998, he went to a bar called the Fireside Lounge for a few drinks. There he met Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, who were around 21 as well, if not exactly 21. And they were like roofers or something, just locals. I believe they both had a record for petty theft and like little things. But they decided that they were gonna pretend they were gay because Matthew was gay and offer him a ride home and rob him. So they offered him a ride home, he accepted. And once they were in the truck, McKinney pulled out a gun and beat Matthew and took his wallet.
Oh.
They drove a mile out of town to a field where they tied Matthew to a log fence. McKinney continued to pistol whip him, struck him in the head roughly 20 times.
Jeez.
They stole his shoes, and he was left naked in the cold for 18 hours before
Oh my God.
a man riding his bike saw him. And initially, like, Matthew was very small. Actually, when the police found him, they thought he was like 13 or 14 because he was just so small. And this guy that found him initially thought it was a scarecrow out in the middle of a field.
That's terrible.
Yeah, and so when he came upon him, he saw it was a person. Matthew was taken to the hospital. He was already in a coma. His brain stem was severely damaged, which your brain stem, I don't know what you know, but that helps to regulate your temperature, your breathing. It helps with your heart rate, things like that. So if your brain stem isn't working, all of those things get fucked up and out of whack. He had hypothermia. He had at least four skull fractures. He hung on for 6 days and then he passed away.
Oh, poor guy.
When McKinney and Henderson left Matthew, they wound up in a fight with an 18 and a 19-year-old. The police arrived and they fled, but they left their truck behind. So police searched the truck and they found Matthew's credit card, his shoes, and a 357 Magnum covered in blood, which would wind up being Matthew's blood.
Yep.
McKinney and Henderson's girlfriends helped hide evidence because they're a bunch of douchebags.
Bitches.
Henderson would plead guilty to murder and kidnapping, and he was sentenced to two consecutive life terms. McKinney didn't want to plead guilty, so he went on the gay panic defense. Matthew hit on him, so he got scared.
Oh, whatever.
Right. He was convicted of kidnapping, aggravated robbery, and second-degree murder. So when it came time to sentencing, he agreed to accept life without parole and no possibility of an appeal instead of getting the death penalty because that's where he was headed. Henderson's girlfriend, Chastity Paisley, was sentenced to 18 months. She only served 6. McKinney's girlfriend, Kristen Price, was sentenced to 180 days and she only served 60. Now, one thing that, so the Matthew Shepard case was huge when this happened. Like, it was all over the news. And a couple of things happened. Number one, I don't know, it was big news, but Westboro Baptist Church, you know those fuckers? You know who they are, right? So they protested his funeral. So, you know, they were like, God's glad Matthew's
Because he
dead. Yeah. And it was horrible. So they that was like the first time I think I ever heard of Westboro Baptist or not heard of them but had seen what they were doing. I had heard they were
was
doing it to soldiers and I didn't really understand that because it was like a soldier died, that doesn't mean he's gay. I don't understand what your problem is.
gay. Yeah.
I never understood all that. But they did protest Matthew Shepard. In addition to that, several movies and a play were made, The Laramie Project was a play that was done and it was really good. I think it was later made into a movie. A lot of things kind of happened after Matthew Shepard. And one thing that really kind of has always stuck in my memory about it is it wasn't at his funeral, but it was at maybe like when they were doing a hearing maybe to pass laws. And Westboro Baptist came back out. And Matthew Shepard's friends decided to get some PVC pipe and some cloth and made angel wings and stood in front of Westboro Baptist to shield the family from them, which was just really freaking moving and cool. Like, that was just really...
That is so sweet.
It was pretty awesome. All right, so, 2009, Obama signed the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. Now, there were hate crime laws already in place, but they were more related to race, color, religion, or nationality. Mm-hmm. Okay? This would expand the hate crime law to include crimes motivated by actual or perceived gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. It also removed a previous requirement, which I didn't know was a thing, that victims had to be engaging in federally protected activity like voting or going to school. So if you were, you know, walking down the street doing nothing, it couldn't be a hate crime.
What?
Yeah, I didn't realize that was a thing. Yeah, apparently that was the thing. And I was like, why would you make it something that has to be a federally protected activity? So many people were being hurt because, especially back in the day, like, because they were black. Yeah. Now, let's talk about that for a minute, because James Byrd Jr. was the other person mentioned on this bill. Let me tell you about him. He was a black man, and he was attacked by three white supremacists. The men had offered him a ride home. They took him to a remote country road, beat him, spray painted his face, urinated and defecated on him, and then chained him to their truck by his ankles.
Oh my god.
Then they drove for 3 miles down an asphalt road, dragging him behind them. He was killed halfway through. His body hit the edge of a culvert and severed his right arm and decapitated him. Then they dumped his body in front of an African American church. Two of them received the death penalty, and one was sentenced to life in prison. But, yeah, that's James Byrd Jr. And he was just minding his own business. They offered him a ride home, and that's what happens.
That's horrible.
So you go back to the federally protected activity, like, he wouldn't have been protected by a hate crime. Now, exactly. They were obviously, they were charged with murder and everything, but a hate crime, I want to say, would have stiffer sentences, but, I mean, two of them got the death penalty.
That's ridiculous.
And the one that was sentenced to life in prison, I want to say, pled guilty, was remorseful, and didn't take as active a part. And that was the only reason he got away with no death penalty. So, yeah. So, those are our 10 cases.
That's ridiculous. Well, I'm glad to know that something good came out of these situations, however horrible these situations. I mean, if we can't prevent the situations from happening, at least some change can be effected that may help others in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, that's all you can really ask for. And it's a shame that these people died for these things to happen, but a lot of these laws have made major changes in so many people's lives.
Definitely. So. And more to come. Unfortunately, we learn from our mistakes, not our successes.
That's true.
And these are mistakes in our, you know, in our past that, you know, we're learning from, and thank God we're learning from them.
Yeah. Hopefully we continue to learn, and, you know, like I said, it makes me sad some of these cases because they had to happen.
Definitely, you know? Of course. This should never have to happen in order to affect positive change.
But yeah, so that's it.
We will be back next week with a new topic. I hope you enjoyed this one. Be kind to one another.
Definitely. Bye.
Bye.